Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So AI is always a big topic for people, and so this age that may also affect our humanity in many ways. So are we still human? It may depend on what we think about machines and whether they are like us or whether we are mere machines and so forth and so on. So our image of ourselves is actually crucially affected here. But first of all, the question is not entirely new. People have tried to make robots for a long time that simulate human beings or other beings. In fact, I read somewhere that it's sometimes attributed even to Albert the Great, but that may be a more obscure reference. Many of these begin in the 17th century in earnest, but still throughout history there are instances, Pinocchio, Frankenstein's monster, the golem, Pygmalion, and other kind of mythologies and tales that people have told about artificial entities that become intelligent, people, consciousness, or whatever you want to say here. Now, the first thing I want to notice about that is that this is typically framed around performance, what a thing can do. And what they simulate in terms of what we can do, then the question is, then are they the same thing as we are? And I think that is, first of all, a difference between functioning and doing on the one hand and being on the other hand. These are two different things that I, first of all, want to point out. And I think intuitively we still know that computers are not what we are, even if they outperform us in many ways already. Computers, if performance would be the thing, there would be more people than we are already. You know, because they're so much smarter, they can do so many more things than we can do. My calculator is calculating much faster than I ever could. But it's not more a person. It is not something that is like me. And so intuitively, we know that. And I mean, there's some things that computers are not yet very good at, like telling jokes. And I think maybe that's not insignificant. But even, let's say, they would be good at that. Would you tell your computer a joke? I don't think you would be tempted to do that, because we wouldn't think that we were understood or that there is a there to enjoy that with us, so to speak. You ever apologize to a computer? You have? Yeah, I mean, our intuitions can be shifting, you know? And maybe you should. I mean, if someone said, I'm treating my computer well, if the AI apocalypse, they will treat me well if I do that. But still, I think our intuitions are really affected also by popular culture. I read a philosopher who says, my thinking about this has been very much influenced by me watching Star Wars. This is really weird if you come to think of it. It's this movie, right? I mean, you can imagine and fake anything you want in a movie that doesn't prove anything, right? In any case, we don't put driverless taxis, and they do drive in San Francisco now, on trial when they have an accident. But if the same is done by a person, we do. We do not experience remorse if we turn off our computer, thinking we have just killed the machine. And that is more significant than you would think. So we have AI dogs, little toy dogs, you know, to entertain elderly people or children, that we can turn off. Tomorrow we'll turn them on again. You don't have to lead them somewhere to leave something behind and so forth. You don't have to feed them, you know, you don't have to worry about their barking. Just turn it off. But tomorrow we can turn it on again. It's very convenient. We cannot do that with a real dog. I think that is significant. Forget about human beings for a moment. Think about living beings. If we could do that, we probably could make life, but we cannot. And that's actually the first important point. If we cannot make life, why would we think that we can make conscious beings, which are a higher form of life? We can come back to that topic later, but this is implied in us not being able to turn living beings back on like a computer. That means it just is something else. The being of a living being is its life. It is not a matter of IQ, as I said. I mean, our computers are doing that better than we do. It's also not a matter of simulation. So machines can simulate what we do in grandiose ways, and it's getting better by the day. They will pass the Turing test. But that's all about functioning, yet again. It's not about being. We'll see what's left out here. But it is what they can do and simulate. Now, if we do a perfect simulation of something, does it then suddenly become the real thing? I don't think so. The difference between appearance and reality, simulation and reality, is not a matter of degree. It's a different in kind. And a more perfect simulation is more of a simulation, not less. So it's not becoming reality, but it's just a more perfect simulation. If you make perfect counterfeit money, it doesn't become thereby real money. It's still a crime. So just to be aware of that. And in that sense, why shouldn't we say that all these simulations that AI can perform now are just basically the same thing as a motion-activated doll? You know, when I grew up, my sister had a doll that you could turn over and it would say mama. Right? It's a little thing in the back that was motion-activated and it would say. So is that in any way, in principle, different from that? It's just more sophisticated, right? So I think these are preliminary questions to ask to open up this whole question. But I think the other thing to consider is, have we started to think of machines like us because we already have thought of ourselves on the model of machines? Professor Meredith said earlier that we learned a lot from steam engines. That not steam engines learn from science, but science from steam engines. Well, the models that we make of ourselves will influence also the way in which we think of ourselves. Our tools may affect how we think of ourselves. If you work on a computer all day long, you may think that you yourself are a computer. And it's in fact something that has been around for quite a while. In the 17th century, you find Thomas Hobbes, you know, trying to think of ourselves, or La Mettrie, whom you quoted earlier. It's a l'homme machine, man as a machine, right? And no soul needed, and so forth. So we ourselves have already reduced ourselves to immaterialistic kind of images of human nature. And therefore, I want to suggest anything that allows us to see about ourselves, what cannot be reduced to matter, will shift our intuitions back to where they should be. It will also shift the burden of proof for why we should think that machines could have consciousness. And therefore, what I want to do first of all is just to look at ourselves. After all, it's about, are we still human, right? And to bring back to our understanding that there are things about us that make us human that are not material in nature, and no material replica produce the same thing. Now, last time I didn't get to enumerate all my points because I ran out of time. Let me try again. So the first point is about what people call qualia. Now you hear quality in that. So it's the qualitative state of how it is to have certain experiences. That is how it feels like to feel heat or cold. To the way red looks to us, the way the rose smells, the way the clarinet sounds or coffee tastes. These are all subjective qualitative experiences. Much of the discussion in especially Anglo-Saxon literature focuses on that as of the feature of what makes us conscious. I think that's itself very reductive. It is an important part, but it's by no means the only thing that goes into consciousness, and we'll see more as we go along. But it is an important part. And for one, among those qualitative experiences is pain. Right? The way it feels like to be in pain. And we do deduce quite a bit of that, because if we were to think that our computers experience pain, we would treat them differently, just as we do with animals. And court rulings also even take that into account when it comes to unborn babies. So pain is an important part of these qualitative experiences. About these, though, if I taste coffee or chocolate ice cream, or if I see something red, if somebody would open my skull and look at my brain at the same time, what would we find? So if we think materialistically, our mind is basically our brain and our nervous system being activated and things like that, if that's all just material, what should we be finding there? Well, if I look at a red chair, something should be turning red up here, right? Or as Thomas Nagel, who talked about these things a lot, said, if I eat chocolate ice cream and somebody would lick at my brain at the same time, it would not taste like chocolate. It's a bit of a gruesome example, perhaps, you know, but it brings home the point, right? And my brain doesn't start to smell like anything. It doesn't look differently. But if my consciousness, my qualitative experience, would be a material thing, then it would be somewhere to be discovered, right? You could say maybe it just needs a stronger microscope to find it in my brain, but the microscope is not going to show you that. Nothing in your brain turns anything like these qualitative states. And that point has been so strong that even a philosopher who doesn't lean in that direction, namely David Chalmers, concedes, you know, that this is a problem and therefore you cannot totally materialistically reduce things. He has a different suggestion. Maybe you can come back to that later. But materialistically, it cannot be explained. So even on the level of pure sense experience, we're not talking about logic, mathematics, algorithms, or whatever. Even on pure the subjective level of experience that we would also think animals have, including pain, nothing in the brain turns out to be of that sort, and we should expect that. It is not our brain that is jubilant or sad, for example, but we are. And experiences are in us and in our minds, or in our brain, if you want, that's a proper location. There's an inness, they're in there in some way, but in a different way than the milk is in the pot. You can look into the pot and see the milk, but that's not how experiences are in the brain. My toothache is in my tooth, also not in the way that the milk is in the pot. Right? You cannot in any way see the toothache there. And nevertheless, I know it's there. So if I go to the dentist and I say I have a toothache, and the dentist looks at the tooth and says, I cannot see anything, you don't have any pain, you would say, well, I have to know better than you, right, whether I'm in pain or not. Apparent pain is real pain. So in this case, actually, appearance and reality are the same thing. You cannot really be skeptical about that. You know when you are in pain. If you hallucinate something blue, nothing turns blue in your brain, but you certainly have that experience regardless of whether there is anything blue out there or not. The appearance of being appeared to bluely, if you want, is the real thing. That is the experience. But nothing in your brain would tell anybody else that you have a blue experience. That is your privilege. As the one who can introspectively see that, that's the kind of innerness, if you want. You introspectively have an access to your own experience that nobody else has. It's private in that kind of a sense. And nothing in physical reality is private in that sense, that, or in that way. And nothing can tell you, from the outside in what state you are. I mean, for example, it's not that you're looking into the mirror, you see you are, your face is all distorted, and you tell yourself, oh, I must be in pain. You're not. I mean, you would know that, right? You know that before that. Or you could, it wouldn't make sense to say, there's pain in this room, but I don't know if it's mine. You know, there's a kind of a mindness to that, you know, that belongs to me in a way that nothing else in the physical world belongs to me. So all of these are very peculiar features that would be very hard to make sense of in materialistic ways. Another aspect that's related, there is a unified field of consciousness. Of how many things are you aware right now? Many, right? Countless. Couldn't even be telling how many, right? I mean, just take your visual field, you know? All the things that you see focally or in the periphery, all of these you are in some or other way aware of. It includes also your thoughts at the same time. It includes what you hear. All of these things are what you're conscious of from many different kind of trajectories or sensations and so forth. All of these are unified. And they're unified by being yours. So nothing that you perceive in this room is by that fact unified in reality. The chairs are still two different things, right? They come together, they're unified only because you are aware of it. It is that they are in your consciousness, you are unifying them, that makes them one in this one field of consciousness. This is to say that consciousness is a unifier. It's a higher form of unity of things that are not otherwise out there unified. Now, that's an important part, too, because nothing in the material world corresponds to that. So, as I said, the various things out there may not be unified amongst each other when they are unified in your mind, but also not in your brain. So, for one, they don't show up in your brain. Nothing in your brain looks unified, and nothing in your brain can cause them to be unified. So what do you have in your brain? You have many neurons. There are the many things in your brain that interact, perhaps, but they're all individual, partial kind of things that are not in any other way unified. So there is no neural correlate for this kind of unification. Something that John Searle and others have pointed out is the binding problem and so forth. Material processes, material states, such as brain states, are intrinsically discrete. Matter is just one part matter and another part, they're all outside of each other. They may interact, but they're not as such unified. That is true on a very basic level of basic awareness that we share with animals. It is even more true if you think of higher cognitive objects. For example, a melody. Apparently, animals cannot hear melody. They also don't perceive rhythm. So if you take a musical thing, in a melody, what you're perceiving is not just individual notes. It has a gestalt, as a unified aspect to that, because each note sounds differently depending on what came before and what comes afterwards. You don't perceive that atomically and then put it together. You perceive it in some way as a whole. And that's an achievement of your mind that requires your mind in some way already to be outside of time so that you can unify that time, right? And so anytime you speak a sentence, right? The sentence is not complete yet, but you anticipate what's going to come. To understand the sentence is to mean, is to take it as a whole from beginning to end, and only then it does mean what it means. You can think your whole biography that way, you know, unifying it in that way. So that in many ways there are unifying features of the mind, perceiving an alley or row of trees, you know, is also kind of a unification, none of which has anything corresponding in the mind. And that is something that already the philosopher Leibniz observed in the 17th century. He was arguing against Thomas Hobbes, who thought such things. He says, if our mind is just our brain, and it's like a mechanism, you can imagine, we could open up our skull, basically, and walk into that brain as if it were a windmill, he says. And then you could see in that all the cogs and wheels that are turning and so forth and so on. But he says, nothing in that would give you the idea of consciousness. You just see the cogs and wheels. And what he was particularly missing, what he thought has to do with what perception is a kind of a unification of all of these parts. And the way I would explain that isn't the way I just did. Or think of neuroplasticity. Right? So you can say, well, brain at least is not like a computer because there's a holistic feature to it, right? I mean, so different parts of the brain can assume certain functions that other parts had before. There's a plasticity about the brain in that way, which means it forms a kind of a whole in which the parts can exchange their functions, something of that sort, right? So that is in some way sounding very unified. But why is that? It's not the brain that explains these holistic features. It is the mind that does that. I think it's an expression of what our mind already is doing as a holistic, unifying feature that we see operative in the brain. The parts of the brain don't do that by themselves. And again, it's just that's true even on the level of perception. So we know that in the brain, particular parts process different things. I think there's a different part for lines, for angles, for colors and shapes or whatever it is. And so different parts of the brain are responsible for one unified experience. But they're parts. They're not unified as a brain. What makes the brain one? It's one thing one could ask here. And all of that, of course, would be even more the case when we talk about AI that doesn't even have neuroplasticity or any of these other features. So that's what I call the unified field of consciousness, and people like John Searle and others have discussed that too. Then, very importantly, intentionality. The color doesn't mean anything. Now, intentionality, in English, we think of practical intentionality. I pursue a purpose. I have an intention to do X, Y, or Z. So something I pursue. But this is a broader term in philosophy, intentionality. It has to do also with theoretical and cognitive kind of things. It is simply that I'm aware of something or that I hope for something. That I doubt something, that I will something, that I love something, that I imagine something. All of these are forms of intentionality. It's always an act that is of something or about something. Now, the question is, in which sense is that or is that not something physical? So in our process, and if you just take basic sense perception, so I see something, what happens? Well, light waves bounce off an object and are reflected into my retina and then are processed, you know, into the brain by my nervous system. But this is basically processed from a thing X out here. It's a causal process that you can describe physically. And here's my eye, and maybe here you have your brain, and that presumably is what you see. But the interesting thing about that is, I mean, that's an important part. I mean, you wouldn't see without it, right? But you're seeing off that object. Right? That's a form of intentionality. Goes in that direction. If you could also imagine here's a series of billiard balls bouncing into each other, right? The billiard ball, the last billiard ball here sees nothing. None of the billiard balls perceive something because it's not conscious, right? But our mind is aware of what affects it, and that is causally upstream. It has the opposite direction of physical causality. And that means it is not itself something physical. Right? Nothing in the physical world corresponds to that directionality. There's some qualification I can make about that, but leave that for later, perhaps. So, but this is a causal process bending back onto its origin, and that you do that in any kind of perception when you are aware of something. That's a unique relation, and it is what characterizes mind. Franz Brentano in the 19th century has made that case very much. Now, this is true even for our emotional life. Atoms don't fall in love with each other, right? but if we love someone, right? And that's a form of intentionality too. Again, our perception is of that kind, and an interesting aspect of that is that it involves our body. And it involves our body in a way that's different from any machine. That is, if I touch this podium, my experience of touch is not in my brain, it is out here. Right? The intentionality of my mind is not just in the brain. Raymond Teller says, it spreads over my whole body like a blush, he says. An interesting image. Right? And so I know with my whole body. I live intentionally into the world through my body. And that is what makes my body alive. That's one way of explaining what life is in a body from the perspective of consciousness. I live through my body. And so Heidegger, for example, will say no physical thing touches another physical thing, really. Touch is something that we do because only we have intentionality. Now, I can take this to touch the podium, or I can take a hammer and hit a nail, right? In this case, you could also say it's not so much the hammer that is touching the nail, but me through the hammer. So I can take this intentionality of my body and vicariously, so to speak, give it to tools. And that is what we do with computers. So we do talk about our tools in precisely that way. That is, robots could be seeking something, monitoring something, trying to do something, taking things to be the case. That's the way we speak. We say some missiles, for example, seek heat. Seeking is intentionality, right? But that's not something in a missile. That's our intentionality. We want it to do that. We built it to do that, and we interpret it as doing it, but that's not something in that tool itself. We say that computers detect key presses, that they try to initialize their printers. They try to do that. They search for available devices. This is all intentional language. And we say they try to do something, and then they may have made a mistake. But machines don't make mistakes. There is no mistake unless you try something, and literally there is nothing trying there, right? So that is something that we read into the machine. It's actually something that even Alan Turing was aware of. Also Daniel Dennett, who is trying to argue for the reductionist picture, he says, well, this is what he calls the intentional stance, right? We interpret things to have these intentions, but they don't literally have it, right? And I think for tools, that's very much the case. The odd thing about Daniel Dennett is that he thought that's what we do with ourselves, too. We, too, don't have intentionality. He knew that couldn't be reduced. So it must be something we just read into ourselves. But what does it mean to take the intentional stance? That's itself a form of intentionality. So then who is reading that into us? You know, some people say there's a little homunculus in us. There's a different sense here. It's like a little man in us who reads our brain or something like that. You know? You have to say that unless you think, you know, there is actually something spiritual going on. And but then who reads that little man, you know? And so you get into an infinite regress. And somehow, unless you have a mind somewhere that actually really does have intentionality, that can take the intentional stance, that will never get off the ground. But that is in us. So the tools indeed are something that we read that way, and that don't literally have that. And so our machines, therefore, don't have that. They have they lack a particular feature of consciousness. Now, there are many other applications of that. For example, an animal. An animal can desire and pursue food. And so Aristotle will say then they have imagination. They can anticipate what they are looking for. They're looking for a gazelle, lion looking for a gazelle, perhaps, and so forth. The gazelle is not yet around. So desire is the desire for something that is absent. It is present to the animal in a certain way, but it is present to the animal as absent. Otherwise, it wouldn't be desire, it would be fulfilled. You know, would already have eaten it. So what enters here is absence. Absence is very important. And a kind of an absence that is absent in computers. What do I mean by that? So if I pursue something out of desire, there's something present here. Desire is present here, but it is about intentionality, about something that's not yet, right? In the future. That's where I look for it. The same is true in the reverse for memory. So if I remember something from yesterday, there is something that's present to me, but precisely as absent because it's yesterday. It's not anymore, right? Otherwise, it would not be memory, but it would be sense perception, right? I cannot taste yesterday's breakfast, right? But I can remember it. But it implies a certain kind of absence. Now, where would that absence be in a computer? We say computers have memory. Well, again, that is something we read into the machine. It's our intentionality that we interpret the machine as representing in some way. But what you have in a material thing are just present states. Absence is not a material state, right? There isn't anything, right, in the physical sense. That is a feature of mind. And we do read it into machines. It's not literally there. And if that's an important feature of consciousness, you will never get it from a physical thing. Now, you can take also absence pure and simple. If I write it on the board, mathematically, say it's minus and plus. What's the meaning of minus and what's the meaning of plus? Well, this is just marks on the board, right? These are physical entities. What the difference between the two is not something you can read off the physicality of these ink marks. That is, let's put it like that. In mathematics, you can say minus times minus equals plus, right? A double negative makes a positive. And if that's a form of the mind coming from our intentionality, this negativity, this absence, then you can say, I have this state of negativity or it enters into the world by my mind, but I can also negate it and therefore say there's something positive here. I can negate the absence and therefore arrive at something present, right? The interesting thing is that the reverse is not the case. And you can wonder why that is. Why doesn't a double plus make a negative? Physical states are all present. They're positive in that sense. And you can never get from a physical state to what is implied in the mental state, namely absences and so forth. But you can do the reverse. You can get from mind to matter, but not from matter to mind in that sense. And that it does, again, have to do with this feature of intentionality and different forms of intentionality, obviously, but these have to do with some of the fundamental things. Just think, you know, what makes it true that there is no elephant in this room? I mean, it's nothing physical, it's an absence. what makes the absence of the elephant different from the absence of a kangaroo in this room? This has something to do with my mind, right? And my mind in relation to what is here present and now and the perceived absence thereof, these are all states of intentionality. And again, nothing in matter could replicate that or be the same thing. Hope you're following so far, right? Related to intentionality, is semantics. Among the tools that we use and that we imbue with our own intentionality is language. So ink marks, sound waves that we use to communicate our minds do not mean things by themselves. They're just material entities like any else. And that they mean something and what they mean is something we read into them. And typically in this case by convention even. So German and English use different words for tree. Totally different words. And you can take any kind of signifier and, you know, by convention say that's what I wanted to mean in the future. But then I imbue it with my meaning, that is the semantics of the words, that are something like intentionality. The word now means something. More fundamentally, it is my mind that means something, and I give that to language so that it means now something, right? So again, that comes also from our mind. It's not something intrinsic to the material signifiers. Now, related to that, you have John Searle's famous Chinese room argument. Have you ever heard about that? Who has heard about the Chinese room argument? Okay, it's pretty simple. Also, you imagine yourself, you're in a little cabin or box, right? And you're supposed to help translate something from, say, Polish to Chinese. And I will assume you know neither of these languages. I don't. So that works by somebody is putting in some Chinese characters from one side through a slit, and you have a chart, and you can match each sign with the Polish counterpart. Then you slide it out the other side. And you may hear some laughter on the other end, and you know you have just passed through a joke, right? But did you know that? No, you didn't, because you had no idea what the words meant. You can have, say, an algorithm, you know, a translation machine, right, that does precisely that without ever understanding the semantics of something or even that there is such a thing as semantics. It's pure syntactical kind of arrangements. It lacks, it has not borrowed, if you want, the intentionality that has to do with our mind. So it's the people who shift in the Chinese signs that have semantics and the ones who read it on the other side, but in between, there is no mind, if you want. In this case, you operate like the machine and you have no idea what it means and you don't need to. Functioning is different from being here again, right? In the case of mind. Now, that implies something else about machines, namely that there is no information in the machine. Another thing that should startle us, right? Talk about computers being able to save so much information or something like that, you know, megabytes, whatever. This is not information in the strict sense of the word. That is something we read as information. Right? In a literal sense, there is no information in a computer. Again, should startle us, right? There's no memory in computers. There is no information in computers because all of that depends on intentionality. Now I'm running short of time. So, briefly, let's see. I mean, all of these things, to a certain extent, we share with animals. Not all of it. Animals don't have language in the way we do, but they do have intentionality. Animals literally and really seek things, right? They pursue things. But we also have something more than that. We have universal concepts of things. We have terms like circle, right? I mean, that is nothing that is physical. Why not?
That's a very badly drawn circle.
And perhaps an image of a circle, but not a real circle. But even if I were to draw a perfect circle, I have a machine doing it for me, it still wouldn't be the concept of circle. Why? Because it's just one circle. I could draw many other circles with different diameters. There are infinitely many circles, and you cannot draw all of them. But any circle that you do draw is one particular circle. It is not the universal of circularity, if you want. Right? Now, if that were a brain state, then by virtue of being material, it would be a particular circle like the one on the board. Anything that is material is by that fact a particular. The same is true for dog. I mean, if I think of dog as a concept dog, nothing looks like a dog in my brain to begin with. And if it did, it would be just one dog, right? And it would be a specific dog. It would be poodle or German shepherd or whatever, but it wouldn't be dogness as such. There's no image that gives you dogness as such. And no concept is an image because any image is particular. But anything that would show up in your brain would be particular. It would not be universal. If you talk about dogs, you mean not just the dogs in the room. You don't just mean the dogs in the present day. You don't mean just the dogs today and in the past, nor the ones in the future. You even talk about dogs that never exist, possible dogs, right? How do you do that? There's nothing centrally affecting you about that, and yet you can think of these things. And you can literally share your mind with somebody else by putting it into language and let them think the same thought. How can that happen? Right? If I have that thought in my mind, that's my brain state. If you have that thought in your mind, that's your brain state. How can it be that we think the same thought? Our brain state, and that has to do with what, no brain is alike. Whatever happens in the brain in each case will look differently. So what makes that the same thought? We also don't share any nerve endings, that would communicate there. How can we think literally the same thought, dog or circle? Well, we do, though, and we must do that, because even to doubt that we do that presupposes that we do. Why? We would disagree about something. We cannot have disagreements unless we agree about something about which we disagree. Right? Otherwise, we have no point of reference about which we could disagree. So we think that thought, and we think both the same thought, and we can communicate about it. That cannot depend on our brains. It can also not depend on machines. That's something spiritual. That's something we need consciousness for. There's another argument people have made that among these universal features are algorithms that we would think are in a machine that perform these algorithms. And they would be universal because it's always the same. It's universally the same operation that's being performed. But the argument has been made that even that is not literally the case in a machine. And it is a little bit what I said earlier about causes and reasons, prescriptive and descriptive laws. Remember that? So I said that could be two calculation machines, and one always says 2 plus 2 is 4, and one 2 plus 2 is 5. And I do operate according to electromechanics. That doesn't make the difference between true and false. That is what we evaluate them by. So we think there should be this algorithm operating in the calculator and evaluated by it. But that's in our mind. That's not literally in the machine. So it may very well be that the computer who always says 2 plus 2 is 4 just does it this time or several times. But, you know, after 100 times it makes, says 2 plus 2 is 6, you know, and then 2 plus 2 is 8, and at a certain point it may return to say 2 plus 2 is 4. You would never know. If you just, it may even just be a pattern that occurs in a sea of chaos, you know, that there's no regularity at all. But even that is not quite the case. Even if we could know that, we wouldn't know what exactly it is designed to do, because that's in the mind of the designer. It could be that the designer wanted it to say 2 plus 2 is 5, and 2 plus 2 is a mistake. So these kind of arguments have been made too, and that leads into the further curiosity that there are also no algorithms in computers. There is really no there. All the things that we associate with the mind are not literally there. It is something that we take it to be doing. And therefore a mistake is also relative to our mind. I just want to get to one last point before I totally run out of time. And that is, some thoughts cannot be in a material brain because they are too simple. Take the thought of one. So the mathematical unity, one. Where would you get that from? You look at the material world. Everything material, St. Augustine says, is extended. Therefore, and everything extended has physical parts. You can chop it up into pieces. From that, you cannot get unity. Everything has parts, and of course, you can also enumerate the parts, but for even to do that, to count them, you presuppose the one by which you count them. You don't get the idea of unity from material things. That comes from your mind. Now, if you want to instantiate that in physical terms, you can say,
that's a mathematical point, right?
But however fine I make the point, it will always be extended, otherwise it's not anything physical at all, right? Absolute unity and simplicity, a mathematical point, is not something material. And it can be merely a symbol of something that is itself not material. That is true for simple things. It is also true for thoughts that are that encompass totalities. Take the thought of everything. You can think that. Huh? It's a very strange thought if you come to think of it. The thought everything. One of the odd things about that thought is that it includes itself. The thought of everything is indeed part of everything. It's one of them, otherwise it wouldn't be anything, right? So the thought of everything includes itself. Now that's another fascinating feature that especially the human mind has, kind of a reflexivity that you cannot find in material things. If you would want to find the equivalent in the material world, it would be something like putting a briefcase into itself. Try to do that. Our thoughts can encompass themselves. They can include themselves in a way that no briefcase can. Any physical object will have that problem. But we do it all the time. When we say I to ourselves, that includes the very thought, that includes myself. Now, the interesting thing is I is also a very simple thought. We all say I to ourselves. That doesn't differentiate us, precisely because it is so simple. It is even something that Alzheimer's patients can still do. They may have forgotten everything about themselves, but they can still say I to themselves. They still have that reflexivity of a thought that includes itself, if you want. And that is itself, I think, an articulation of what unifies our field of consciousness, what I've talked about earlier. So it's all my thought. It's the I that unifies all of these, right? And I can now reflexively think that. That's a particular thing of the rational mind. So perhaps the last point on that. So without reflexivity, I can come to reflect on myself and I can change my mind. And that is something that no computer can do. And I think that's an important thing because people will tell you that computers may start to upgrade themselves and all the way to the singularity and then they take over the world or something like that. You know, the robot apocalypse would maybe work in that way. But no computer has ever built a computer better than itself. You can prove me wrong on that, but I think that is still true. And no computer has upgraded itself. Because in order to do anything, it has to use the mechanics by which it is built, the algorithms that we build into it, the learning algorithms that it knows, that it uses, are not themselves part of what you unlearn or and so forth. So it has to use the algorithms that it cannot then, or the source codes that it cannot change. But we can do that. We reflect on ourselves, can transcend ourselves, and change our mind. And so I think that is an important feature for rational minds. That's what makes us creative. That's also, I think, linked to free will, which would be a final point that I'm not making because we talked about that earlier. Computers cannot have free will because all of that would be presupposed for that. And so if that is true, then we don't have any reason to think that machines can be people, that they have consciousness, let alone an immortal soul, and therefore we would not baptize them. I've heard somebody from Hewlett-Packard says we have to evangelize these robots and baptize them. So, but I don't think we have any reason to think that because the features I told you about are what makes us rational beings, what make us human. We are still human, yes. And that's why we need to be baptized, but not computers. And I think maybe here's where I stop. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.